This is the last day of this January 2014 Rohatsu 7-Day Sesshin. And we'll take up a koan today. This is it's from the Blue Cliff Record, number 13. Haryo's Snow in a Silver Bowl. Here's how it goes, very short. A monk asked Haryo, "What is the school of Kanadeva?" Haryo said, "Snow in a silver bowl." We have a little material on Haryo. I can use his Chinese name. It's not that hard to pronounce. although... who's to say if I'm doing it right, but it's short anyway, Ba Ling. So Ba Ling's Snow in a Silver Bowl. Ba Ling was a disciple of the great Yunmen, Umon. And I'm reading here from Zen's Chinese Heritage, The Masters and Their Teachings by Andy Ferguson. And he says that the little biographical material we have on Ba Ling is sketchy. When Ba Ling first met Yunmen, Yunmen asked Ba Ling, "Master Shui Feng said, 'Open the gate and Bodhidharma comes.'" And then Yunmen, addressing Ba Ling, says, I ask you, what does this mean?" Ba Ling said, blocking the master's nostrils." Yunmen said, "The spirit king of the earth unleashes his evil. A demon leaps from Mount Sumeru up to Brahma heaven and pinches the nostrils of the heavenly emperor. Why have you concealed your body in Japan?" Ba Ling said, "Better that the master not deceive people." Yunmen said, "Pinching this old monk's nostrils, how will you do it?" Ba Ling was silent. Yunmen said, "Now I know you're just studying the flow of words." So it was not an auspicious beginning. When Ba Ling then took up residence later as a teacher, he did not create a document of succession for his students. He only used three turning phrases as the way to attain the essence of the Yunmen school. So he was a Dharma heir of Yunmen. So this is quite unusual. Another source said that he was somewhat eccentric, brilliant. So here, rather than leave succession papers, he left these three turning phrases, and each one is short, and one of them is today's koan. So the first one is, a monk asked, "What is Tao? What is the way?" Ba Ling said, "A clear-sighted person falls in a well." Second one, a monk asked, "What is the hair against which What is the sword against which a hair is blown?" There are many translations for this. The blown feather sword. In other words, a sword is so sharp, just a hair blowing against it will be sliced. It's referring to the ultimate principle, the Dharma. So what is the blown feather sword? Ba Ling said, "Each branch of coral reflects the bright moon." And then the third one, a monk asked, "What is the teaching of Kanadeva?" Baling said, snow in a silver bowl. Yunmen, when he heard these three phrases that Baling left, he said, in the future, on my remembrance day, just restate these three turning phrases and you will have repaid my benevolence. Later, when Yunmen's memorial did occur, it was in accordance with his instructions. Baling, some source said that he would always walk around with a tattered kneeling cloth, what the monks lay down when they're going to do prostrations. A monk asked Baling, the meaning of the ancestors and the meaning of the sutras, are they the same or different? Baling said, the cold fowl flies up in the tree, the cold duck dives into the water. The same or different? A monk asked, I don't doubt the three vehicles and the 12 divisions. This is a way of referring to the Buddhist canon, the writings. What is the main affair of our school? Baling said, it's not an affair of patch-robed monks. The monk asked, what is the affair of patch-robed monks? Baling said, while eating, seeing the white waves, losing the hands and forearms. Are you completely one with eating, with no thought in the mind, no hands or forearms, no body, no mind, no eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind. When Baling was leaving the mountain, he gave his whisk to a monk. This is the horsehair whisk that is one of the accoutrements of a teacher. Traditionally, it's used as to do a purification ritual at the altar and other places. He gave his whisk to a monk. The monk said, originally, there is only purity. Of what use is a whisk? Baling said, once you have known purity, nothing can be forgotten. That's all the material we have on Baling or Haryo. And we'll turn to the koan, such as it is. A monk asked Baling, what is the school of Kanadeva? Kanadeva was one of the, we'll know, people who are familiar with the ancestral line will recognize the name as one of the great Indian ancestors, patriarchs. He was the Dharma heir of Nagarjuna. Nagarjuna is one of the really great luminaries of the Indian ancestors, who is considered to have brought Buddhist philosophy to completion. Brilliant master, enlightened master. A lot of Buddhist philosophy is based on his writings, his understanding. Kanadeva was known for his own brilliance and for his ability to argue before becoming a Buddhist monk. He was a philosopher who was known for how he could talk out of both sides of his mouth at once. He could effectively argue with either side of an issue. In his, they would have these big public debates in the monasteries in India, and he was famous for using non-Buddhist as well as Buddhist devices in those debates or Dharma duels. He would answer questions with opposites. He came to be known as one of his names. They all have all these different names. It's part of the complexity of tracking these masters. One of his names was Khan, and because of his brilliance with words and his ability to argue, he came to be known as Chattering Khan. And it was with some disparagement in Zen, because of course in Zen we don't have much use for words. You know, that is to say, we don't have much use for argumentation. But then he came to prove himself as Kanadeva. And so with this monk's question, asking Ba Ling, what is the school of Kanadeva? So even though he was a Buddhist monk, he was an unusual Buddhist monk, his teaching was unique in his employment of words. So you could say that his teaching was the Dharma, but it was a Dharma that took a unique form. So perhaps behind this question is what kind of Buddhist teaching was this, anyway? And then Ba Ling's answer, snow in a silver bowl. The duality that Kanadeva used in his teaching, the use of opposites, taking opposite sides, that whole dual thing, is one that, of course, is a big part of Buddhism, but understood to be ultimately not two. We see this in affirming faith and mind, in this emphasis on the non-dual and seeing, as Chuang Tzu said, behind the divisible, there is always something indivisible. Kanadeva, in his use of Tunis. He certainly would have, as a great master, he would have understood that ultimately there are not two. Ultimately, and yet we can speak of two. This is the substance of every koan in Zen. Every koan is a unique, its own unique interplay of these two aspects of existence. What we could call the form aspect and the emptiness aspect. But it's almost always implicit, these two sides. There are other words on the form side. We could say this is the side of appearances. It's the side of phenomena. Standing in complementary relationship to it is the side of emptiness, that's non-form, the formless, or standing opposite phenomena is the noumenon, the one, and then going back to the other side, the form or phenomena side is the many. On that side, you could also say the functioning of phenomena, and back over to the other side of the emptiness is the essence. It's just a way of sort of getting a handle on our true nature. But of course it's only words, and so it only goes so far. But it's an ancient concept. It's an ancient way of framing everything. The Chinese, the ultimate principle, that of non-differentiation, oneness, emptiness, the noumenon, essence, is known as li, li, and the other side is ri, ri. Every koan is pointing to reality, our true nature, Buddha mind, essential nature, in its own way. And the task of a koan, when a student is facing a koan, is to find a way to bring those two together. Because they are together. We don't have people walking around with a dividing line where there's the form part of them and the emptiness part of them. We don't have squirrels or trees or stars or anything doing that. It's all integrated in reality. We speak of these two sides. My favorite example is the coin. A coin we can speak of, a heads and a tails, but in reality, it's just that. Just the coin. You can't slice it thin enough to separate form and emptiness, the form side and the emptiness side. And what is so challenging about demonstrating koans is just that they have to be demonstrated. It's easy enough to talk about koans, explain them in terms of phenomena and equality and differentiation, form and emptiness and so forth. But to make that real through a presentation, a physical presentation, forces us to integrate them in our understanding, to embody them. It starts with Mu, or any breakthrough koan. What is it? Mu, like every other koan, like every other phenomenon, is the integration of these two aspects, form and emptiness. And there's so many others. When Gute raised up a finger, there it is. Form and emptiness, emptiness, form. But Buddha held up a flower, the same. When Joshu challenged the two hermits, they each stuck up their fists and he gave opposite replies, same. Another expression of true nature. Nansen cutting the cat in two. Tozan's 3 pounds of flax. Umon's, when asked, what is Buddha? A shit stick. There is a great analogy for koan work that appears in the Three Pillars of Zen. Roshi Kaplo is quoting Heinrich Zimmer. And Zimmer is talking about certain types of meditation, but this is especially true of koans that must be demonstrated and cannot be explained. And this is what Zimmer said, knowledge is the reward of action. So we can make that understanding is the reward of action. For it is by doing things that one becomes transformed. Executing a symbolical gesture, actually living through to the very limit a particular role, one comes to realize the truth inherent in the role. Suffering its consequences, one fathoms and exhausts its contents. Snow in a silver bowl. It's not giving away much to say that this is form and emptiness, emptiness and form. Which is which? Well, we know snow is pretty close to being formless. It's one step away, one warm day away from being formless. The bowl is the container. Certainly that has to be the form. And here again, we see two-ness. There's a koan in the Book of Serenity, the Shoyo Roku. It goes like this. Kaoshan asked Elder De, the true Dharma body of Buddha is like the vast sky. It manifests form in response to things like the moon and the water. There's another one, form and emptiness. How do you explain this responsiveness? And De said, it's like a donkey looking into a well. Kaoshan said, well said, but that's only 80% of it. Deshan said, how about you, teacher? And Kaoshan said, it's like the well looking at the donkey. Form and emptiness, equality and differentiation, eternity and time, empty space and relativity. These are only separable, only divisible through the discriminating mind. A rabbit is a perfect fusion of equality and differentiation. Doesn't know it. In Huayan Buddhism, another sect, great sect of Buddhism, there's the example of a golden lion. So the lion is the form. The gold is the basic principle, the undifferentiated. The undifferentiated only can express itself through the form, can only be manifest itself in form. Gold, when it's melted, can assume the shape of whatever form there is, like a Buddha made of gold. Working on a koan, I don't need to tell people this, but it's, you go through so much, and are able, as Zimmer said, to fathom and exhaust its contents by and by. But it all happens through one's own work. It has to be experiential. To be of any value, it has to become revealed through experience, not through explanation. That's why it's so not only foolish but unfair to even consider trying to explain a koan, especially a simple breakthrough koan, to anyone. And coming to awakening is like the following story, which is learning the art of burglary. This comes from a treasure of world literature called The Man of Many Qualities. And the subtitle is A Legacy of the I Ching. Here's how it goes. The son of an aging burglar, decided that it was about time for him to learn the profession to support the family. So he asked his father for lessons. The father approved the proposal and took him along on the next attempt. They broke through a fence, stealthily entered a mansion, and opened a large chest. The father suggested that the son step into the chest and pick out the valuables. When the son did this, as soon as he got in, the father dropped the lid, locked the chest, sneaked out into the courtyard, loudly knocked on the door, waking the whole household, and fled through the hole in the fence. The excited residents scurried around with their candles and discovered that the thief had gotten away. Meanwhile, the son, imprisoned in the chest, was terribly afraid. An idea flashed through his mind. He made a scratching noise like a mouse, and at that sound, the master of the family sent the maid to investigate. When the maid unlocked the chest, out jumped the boy, who blew out the candle, pushed the maid aside, and ran off with the neighbors on his heels. As he passed a well, he hit upon a second thought. He picked up a large stone and dropped it into the well with a loud splash. Hearing the sound, the pursuers all gathered around the deep and dark hole, attempting to see the burglar drowning himself. The boy ran on. Safely back home at last, the youngster blamed the old man for the harrowing experience. And the father was sympathetic. He said, "Tell me, how did you get away?" And the son recounted the whole thing in detail, to which the father finally smiled and said, "There, son, you have now learned the art of burglary." You can be sure it was somewhat painful for that father to leave the son all alone with his own devices. It is painful, but that's how you acquire true understanding, is going through the experience. It's painful for both, of course. And it points to the fact that compassion takes many forms, and to dish out answers to the student is not compassionate. We all are in this together. The student wants to grow, the teacher wants to see the student grow, and so that's the way it has to be, working. And it's not just koans, it's zazen, of course. Every one of us is left to our own resources, which because we have to draw from them, we discover resources we never knew we had, wisdom we never knew we had, insights that come to us that never would have had we been spoon-fed the Dharma, the words, the doctrine. Snow in a silver bowl. There's one that reminds me of this. This is a case in a later koan collection called the Denko Roku, the Transmission of Light. It's allegedly the awakening accounts of all of the ancestors in our ancestral line. And the last one, it just goes up as far as Zen Master Dogen, in the 13th century, yeah, so not all. But here's how it goes. Koan Ejo, you'll recognize that name from the full ancestral line, Koan Ejo came to Dogen. One day in the course of seeking guidance, he heard the expression, "A single hair pierces many holes." At these words, he was suddenly awakened. That evening he went to the teacher's room, made his bows, and said, "I don't ask about the single hair, but what about the many holes?" Dogen smiled and said, "Completely pierced." And at that, Ejo bowed. Snow in a silver bowl. A single hair pierces many holes. Every branch of coral reflects the bright moon. We have, of course, some of the same. I mentioned the affirming faith in mind, how much the same theme of the absolute and the relative, the oneness and the manyness, speech and silence, is articulated in affirming faith in mind. We also have the harmony of relative and absolute, Relative, of course, is the form side, the differentiation side. The absolute is the other. The subtle source is clear and bright. The branching streams, the many branching streams, flow through the dark. Forms differ in their character. Forms differ in appearances. Sounds may be pleasant or harsh. The dark makes all words one. Root and branches return to the great reality. Light and darkness are a pair, like the foot before and the foot behind in walking. Snow in a silver bowl. Everyday life fits the absolute as a box in its lid. The absolute and relative work together like two arrows meeting in midair. Everyday life fits the absolute as a box and its lid. Sooner or later, if we practice long enough, we come to see that there is really nothing to Zen. It's a certain designation. It's okay, it's fair enough. It designates a certain kind of teaching, a method of practice, a whole tradition, yes. But the essence of Zen is nothing. It says the essence of everything is nothing. It's not a thing. It's like a template. Like a clear template. You know, these art books or maybe geography books, big coffee table books, and some of them have these plastic sheets in them with figures on them, designs on them, and then you can turn that plastic sheet and it lays that design over the facing page. Well, Zen is like that plastic template, except it's clear. It's there, but it's not there. Dogen was asked what he had realized. My eyes are horizontal, my nose is vertical. Snow in a silver bowl. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.